Log Talk Radio.
Well, good Monday afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Military Monday with John D. Gresham. This is actually not John Gresham. This is Daria DiGiovanni, otherwise known as Daria Ann, the founder of the Rightstream Radio Network, of which Military Monday is a part, I am very happy to say. For those of you who are unfamiliar with John, which I can't imagine you are because I write about him a lot, he is a military historian, journalist, and author who has worked with many well-known authors. And I'm going to go ahead right now and introduce him and bring him on the line so we can go ahead and get this broadcast started. John, are you there?
I am, Daria, and if you have those numbers, you might want to try and call our hopeful guest. He's still trying to call in. And good afternoon, everyone. This is John Gresham from Fairfax, Virginia, and welcome to the inaugural edition of Military Monday. It's a show that Daria and I have been working on for several years, and I think we just had our caller come on in, and I'll be introducing him in a minute. Our intention with this show, quite frankly, is to go and do a specifically military show. It's not designed to be a political show. In fact, we're going to try and stay away from politics to the greatest degree possible. Our intent, in all honesty, is to go ahead and talk about the military in general, and specifically the warfighter, what they're dealing with, what's going on in their world, new things that are coming along with them, and hopefully to give them a little bit more of a voice, because as those of you who are familiar with the military know, they don't have one. Legally speaking, they are not entitled under UCMJ to go ahead and express personal and political opinions. So hopefully we can give them at least a little bit of a voice and a chance to know what we're doing. That said, obviously the story du jour is something called sequestration. This is obviously the big financial confrontation here in Washington, D.C., but it's having huge effects on the military because half of the proposed cuts under sequestration legally must come out of the Department of Defense and their funding base. And we have a wonderful, wonderful guest today. He's an old friend of mine. His name is Michael Fabey. Those of you who may be familiar with military journalism have seen him write for papers like the Philadelphia Inquirer, where he did some of his early work. That was his hometown. The Virginia Pilot, where he covered both the Navy and the ship construction industry down there, as well as papers in Savannah. He now holds the rather esteemed post of Naval Editor at Aviation Week and Space Technology, arguably the finest journal on aerospace technology ever in publication. And it's been going strong for over 70 years now. The Aviation Week has had such legendary people write for them as Dave North and David Fulgham, who are people that I've known and worked with off and on over the years. And Mike has taken over now their new area of interest, which is naval technology and U.S. Navy construction. And I'm hoping that we can talk to him. Are you out there, Mike?
Here.
Excellent. Sorry for the trouble calling in, but we should be fine. And Daria, thank you for handling the board for us today. So, Mike, let's start out and kick it right into gear. What is sequestration? What is the intent of sequestration, or what was the intent of sequestration when it got started?
Well, I can tell you from the military standpoint how the military leaders see it, because all the politics of it, I'll leave that to folks who cover that.
But well, there are other talk shows in America that will be talking about that today. We're talking about the military effect.
Right. For sequestration for military purposes, what this means is you're going to have these legislated reductions from programs, and the interpretation that the administration has taken on this and thus the Pentagon, is you're going to have 10% right off the top of every program that they have. And for my bailiwick on the Navy programs, this is especially something that this can be a killer because, as CEO Mike Petters at Huntington Ingalls says, you can't bail 10% of a carrier. So they've already had incredible cuts in defense lately as we've pulled back from the wars. And this on top of that, as well as the continuing resolution, I'm sure we'll get into that, is just creating all kinds of chaos with the budgeting process right now.
And we're going to focus in on how this affects the U.S. Navy to try and provide the listeners with a bit more information about how we're doing, how this is being dealt with. And that organization you're talking about, Huntington Ingalls, describe Huntington Ingalls and where it sits in the defense contractor base today.
Okay, Huntington Ingalls right now, it basically makes, on one side of Newport News Shipbuilding, which builds our carriers, and half of the subs, the sub program. They've also, down in Pascagoula, they build destroyers. They build our LHDs. They build our amphib ships. They essentially are the nation's top shipbuilder as far as overall Navy program, especially surface ships, go. And right now, I mean, they are spun off recently from Northrop Grumman. Northrop had gone and built, bought up pieces of shipbuilding around the country, and then they spun off this organization that's actually much stronger than when it went in as far as a shipbuilder goes, because now you've got all of the major programs under one roof.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but Huntington Ingalls, as it sits there today, is not only the largest shipbuilder in America, but in fact the biggest employment base, private employer, in both Mississippi and Virginia, correct?
Oh, absolutely. And right now, especially down in Tidewater, Virginia, that southeastern corner, I mean, they are the big gorilla as far as employment goes down there. There's nothing in that region doesn't happen sort of that doesn't touch on Newport News Shipbuilding, Huntington Ingalls Arm down there.
And from my own reporting that I've done over the years, I know for a fact that people regularly commute in from upwards of 100 miles away every day, coming and going for those great-paying, great-quality, fantastic benefits jobs that Huntington Ingalls offers, right?
Oh, you've got a lot of Carolina tags, even South Carolina tags that are coming into that yard.
So anyway, here we are. It's the first Monday of sequestration. And let's talk about what sequestration has already done to the U.S. Navy and its contractor base. And I'm going to reference a very well-known picture. It's appeared on articles I've written for Defense Media Network. It's a picture of the main carrier pier across the James River from Huntington Ingalls, and it's a picture of five aircraft carriers sitting in dock. Tell us what that picture really means when you talk about the total base of sea power within the U.S. Navy.
Well, there's two issues that you brought up. One is the sea power, and the other is the industrial base. As far as sea power goes, I mean, right now you're not seeing the kind of sea power that you normally would have out there. And while the Navy officials say they can get by with some of the stuff they have out there anyway, I mean, the fact of the matter is you're not having a couple of carriers over in the Gulf like you normally would have. And you're not going to get that carrier presence even on a global effort that you would normally have. On the industrial base side, right now you've got carrier programs that are being held up, delayed, and just sort of put in kind of a limbo land right now. The biggest one now, the Lincoln, they were supposed to do that midlife overhaul, and that's where they take, as you know, they take all the carriers out. They put the carrier through the real, it's almost like rebuilding the innards of it.
This is the midlife refueling and rebuilding that all of the nuclear aircraft carriers go through, and the Abraham Lincoln happens to be the carrier in the current cycle for a couple years in the main dry dock across the river at Newport News.
Exactly. Now, initially what they said, they were just going to put that entire thing on hold. The Navy found $40 million that they could reprogram, very selectively reprogram, to basically do the kind of prep work. It's not the actual work, just the prep work, to keep it kind of alive and humming until they get the carrier in there. But as the Congressional Research Service just put out in a report just a couple weeks ago, that could do, though, is wind up shortchanging the funding for that for this fiscal year. So even if they start that work, it's going to have to kind of be like a slow start. They'll have to, like, you know, stretch out the program or delay even again. So once you get a carrier out of that cycle, that pushes back the cycles for all the carriers after that, because putting a carrier in that kind of work, that takes years of planning, let alone years to actually do. And once
procurement
kind
of long lead items, getting of specialized personnel for the refueling, which, by the way, affects the defueling of the Enterprise, which we're in the process of decommissioning right now.
That's right.
So, so part of this is, of this $40 million that was reprogrammed, obviously is designed to retain those key workers, of which there are roughly 2,400 at risk across the river at Huntington Ingalls, correct?
Right. That's exactly right. They're saying, okay, we're getting a carrier ready, because that work would have to be done at this point in time right now. So at this moment, that program is continuing as planned at this moment. Now, that would take usually a few weeks, maybe a couple of months, depending on what some of the prep work they have to do and what they find. But after that is if this goes in, for example, to another quarter of issues, well, you've got
that's when
problems.
You hit the big burn rates in terms of large-scale personnel working on Lincoln, having to actually cut down into the structure of the ship and start removing the reactor cores from the two reactors and handling, and getting ready to do the waste disposal.
Right.
And we're talking big bucks and a big burn rate on money at that point.
Absolutely.
In terms of what this is doing, you also pointed out that this has a domino effect going down through the other 10 units of the Nimitz class, and I believe it's George Washington, which is out in Japan, which is scheduled to come in about 3 or 4 years to go ahead and do her refueling cycle?
Sure, that may seem like a long time, but when you're talking about carrier building or refueling or anything like that, that's a very short period of time. It's almost like a ballet of carriers that they actually have to put this through. And so to delay this work now, the Washington could wind up coming in and being laid up, if that's the case. There's a lot of things that could wind up happening as this effect kind of, like, as you said, causes the dominoes down the line with all the carriers in the fleet.
And at the same time, of course, over on at a dock not that far away from the dry dock where the Lincoln's going to be going into here shortly, hopefully, there's another ship, the USS Gerald Ford, a brand-new class nuclear aircraft carrier, which is in the process of fitting out and getting ready. And what's this doing to her final construction, as well as the early construction of the follow-on John F. Kennedy, which is going to be going into the big dry dock here shortly?
Well, on the construction as it is now, it really may not have that much of an effect. The problem will be as they find out more things they have to do to Ford. Because you got to remember, that an awful lot of the technological advancements on the Ford were supposed to be spread out over three carriers. A few years ago, the Pentagon said, no, we're going to put on one carrier, which increased the risk and made it a much more difficult ship to build. And that's one of the reasons that the price tag is going up and up and up. And the Navy officials believe that price is still going to keep on going up and up. But what they don't know is what's going to happen is they start finding, for example, that the EMALS aren't exactly functioning they should be, that kind of
EMALS
thing.
EMALS are the new electromagnetic
right.
catapults, as well as the new arresting gear that are going on it.
Exactly.
And the new power distribution system that'll be going ahead and running the ship.
Exactly. You've got a kind of a Nimitz shell on that, but an awful lot of the other things will be reconfigured or, as you said, all new systems put on there. And so they expect more problems to come out of that. And as that comes down the line, it's going to be an awful hard to find some of the money that they need. And they're also trying to get the long lead items for the next ship to Kennedy. I mean, it's that whole domino effect. With the carrier construction, that's especially harmful. Because it takes so long to build this, the supplier base is so thin right now, and if you delay it, some of these suppliers can go out of business or go into another business.
Correct me if I'm wrong. The cost of the first ship of the class, the Ford, is already estimated at somewhere north of $17 billion. Correct.
That's right. That's right.
And we're looking at $12 to $13 billion for the production versions. The first of which will be the Kennedy, and then supposedly the Enterprise. So
the one thing that might come into play there is that the Navy is sort of hinting around a possible kind of a a block buy or kind of a pseudo block buy for their other carriers, which could reduce it like maybe a half a billion here or there, but it's going to be nothing, you know.
And a lot of this has to do with the fact that we're already buying Navy ships, particularly carriers, at very uneconomical rates. Back just 15 years ago, we were buying one every 4 years, and you could actually afford to buy two at once and then spread them out over time, as opposed to now where the building cycle is, what, 8 years?
Something along those lines. I mean, just give you an idea of how expensive this can be. The construction price for the hull, just the hull, mind you, but still the hull of the Reagan going back into the late 90s, mid-90s, was about $2.5 billion.
Which is not a little bit of money. That's a national investment level of for this.
Sure, but the hull's down more than double that.
So we've talked about what sequestration is doing. In other words, it's going to go and slow things down and make decision-making hard, especially long-range planning. And that's over on the commercial side. And, of course, this is just one program. We've got, what, about 8 or 9 major warship programs running right now, including submarines, ballistic missile boats, amphibious, 3 classes of amphibious ship we're working with, as well as the new littoral combat ship. All of this runs through something called the Naval Sea Systems Command. How are they going and doing in terms of managing all of these programs and the fiscal uncertainty that comes from the fact that we've been operating without a budget for 4 years? We've been operating under something called the Continuing Resolution. Talk a little about that.
Well, the Continuing Resolution is especially particular, shall we say, for Navy programs, because the language in that, when it comes to ships, it's not like a block of aircraft. The ships themselves represent, each one is almost an entire class in itself, let alone a class of ships. So Congress has been very specific in saying how much money can be spent for each program in each way. So there's not a lot of wiggle room for that. So you get a continuing resolution that basically says, by according to Congress, you can only spend so much for specific programs. Going from here, and now you've had that, as you said, for the last 2, 3, 4 years. And on top of that, sequestration, which cuts it back by about 10%, that's being incredibly challenging, isn't the right word, for Navy officials right now as they try to work through this. They're already talking, for example, about cutting back, and, you know, it's a question of right now that they're trying to figure out not only how to build the new ships they want, and they say they need, for example, like the littoral combat ships. But also, they've had an issue where they have not been maintaining the surface ships, especially of the fleet they have. A lot of that has to do with the, you know, the op tempo, the amount of time they've been out at sea because of the two wars so far away and everything like that. So they've been ignoring maintenance. It's come down to a critical head where they have to do all this kind of very deep dive maintenance on an awful lot of these ships. We're talking about major programs that are really just need all kinds of equipment refurbishing and stuff like that. And they're trying to figure out a way they can do this at the same time by new ships.
I'd like you to take a hold on that. We have a caller online, and we'd like to go ahead and let him ask their question, please.
Sure.
Are you there, caller?
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, sir. What is your question?
Hey, how you doing today? Good to hear the two of you all together. Wanted to go a little less strategic and a little bit more down to the tactical level. What are we seeing as far as decisions for manpower being made to support all the different programs that are in the works and are on the surface right now?
I'm going to take a crack at the civilian side of that, and Mike, you can talk a little more about the deck plates. In terms of civilian support for all the programs, everybody in DOD is essentially starting later this month is going to take a 20% haircut, if you will. In other words, they are going to go and be told to take 1 day off in 5 each week for the remaining 22 months of fiscal year 2013. That'll end on October 1st when hopefully by that time there will be a solution. But until that time, Navy personnel, Army personnel, all DOD civilian personnel are going to be only 80% employed, which of course is going to promote wonderful professional motivation and morale. Mike, talk a little bit about what's happening over on the actual military side, if you will.
Well, right now, I mean, obviously, we're not going to talk furloughs in the sense of our uniformed personnel. They are trying to weed out the ranks as much as possible that they can, especially is, you know, the one spot where I've heard it mentioned the most is Marines. They just have way too many Marines in uniform and are trying to weed out as many as they can. The one thing that the Navy has been trying to push is trying to get its sailors off the deck place as much as possible. They've been going for all kinds of manning different strategies so they can reduce the manning on their ships. So far, it hasn't worked that well, but that's the new class of destroyers, and there's only going to be three of them, are optimally manned. They're designed to have fewer people on board. The littoral combat ships, again, you have a littoral combat ship, and to use an analogy, a Star Trek analogy, your Sulu, your navigator, and your Scotty, your chief engineer, could be one person on a littoral combat ship. And that's what they're trying to do now, is trying to basically get as many people off the ships that they can and replace with as much automation as they can.
A good point there. The Nimitz-class ships, the actual crew of the ship minus the air wing is about 3,500 personnel. The newer Ford class will hopefully be about 600-700, maybe even 800 personnel fewer, because they won't have to maintain all the steam plant and piping for the catapults as well as the hydraulics for the arresting gear. Does that give you some answer to your question, sir?
Yeah, it sure does. And I really do appreciate it. And again, glad to see you all together again.
Thank you for the call. Mike, as we move over onto the other side of the James River to Naval Station Norfolk, and, of course, what's going on out in San Diego and Pearl Harbor as well, what do we see happening in terms of deployments and such? How is sequestration affecting deployments? And is there not a feeling of a certain disingenuous bit of behavior by the government regarding this?
Well, certainly there's a sense of showboating, although the Navy people were quick to say, no, it'd be show shipping because we don't have boats. But
we don't have boats, yes.
Yeah, right. There is a sense that certainly in Navy, with the Navy with the ships, because I would say there's some of the the most visible representations of presence going forward. There's a sense of taking a very hard-line interpretation of sequestration and therefore stopping deployments in their tracks, really pulling back. They're talking about, for example, AMPHIB's not going out next year. They're pulled back already on the carrier force. And
the Truman deployment, which was canceled 2 days before it was supposed to happen.
Exactly.
And then 2 days later, they announced that they're going to send the Eisenhower out with the air wing and portions of the escort from the Truman group. Is it not true that it looks like there's just a little bit of confusion in terms of what's going on deployments and such?
Well, sir, I mean, on one hand, you have the carrier cancellation and then the carrier kind of the sleight of hands with the card, then which card is the ace of diamonds as you switch them around. And also, I mean, you know, interestingly enough, they couldn't put the carriers out, but they protected the littoral combat ship USS Freedom's maiden deployment over to Asia, over to Singapore, to make sure that ship went out.
We're going to talk a little bit more about that here in a while. But let's talk a little bit about what's happening to the sailors and Marines who were supposed to go out on the Truman and didn't, and the ones who were on the Eisenhower coming back and are going and doing a quick turnaround and heading out. What kinds of effects do we see in those two different groups? And understanding that when you talk about a battle group, you're talking about 6,000-7,000 personnel all going out at once.
Yeah, I mean, that's you know, these, the sailors on that, and for the most part, let's be honest, they're mostly young kids. And so they live, you know, it's not day to day, but they certainly, you know, especially on a carrier like that, it's year to year. And so when they're set to go out in deployment, they're going to do things like, for example, cancel leases on apartments, find places, storage places for their goods. They put their lives on hold for that. Now you've got, you know, a couple thousand people back who, you know, I wouldn't say have no place to live, but it's going to be very challenging for them in many cases to kind of like sort of restart their lives in a way.
And they're not going to have as much money because you get more money when you're out on deployment than you do when you're sitting at base.
Absolutely. 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 And they count that money. There's a lot of people who count that money for all kinds of things, from certain kinds of child care. Some of these are kids. They've gone out and bought automobiles, for example. They're counting that money to help pay for it. And there's all kinds of things that go into this. It's a huge disruption for the personal lives for the sailors. There's no doubt about it.
And for their loved ones, for their dependents and such, same thing. They were planning on going to school. They were going to go live with parents for 6 months or a year. And all of a sudden, it's thrown the lives of the dependents of those 6,000 or 7,000 sailors and Marines into something of a cocked hat, no less.
Right. Yes.
And, of course, now let's go to look at the other group, the people on board the Eisenhower group who were coming back and suddenly have to turn around and go back out again. They are going out on board a tired ship with a tired crew, and they have to go out and do another 6 months or more, depending upon the contingency. What's that going to do to the morale of those people, and how will that affect retention when they get back?
Well, the morale, I mean, I think that's a pretty obvious answer. And I would say, you know, for the sailors on board, not sure how much they'll be affected. I know a lot of the sailors on board those carriers who kind of enjoy the life at sea. But for the families at home who are expected to have them back, that can be huge. That really can be huge. You have people, again, who have been planning all kinds of things based on having that person home. And now that person's not going to be home, and you can just imagine in your own life if you were, you know, expecting to be someplace and you weren't, and weren't going to be for, you know, months at a time now, it's going to be a big deal. As far as retention goes, I have to say, as I said earlier, right now the services are, the retention is so high for the services that I don't think they're worried. They're definitely not worried about that as much as they used to be. Let's put it that way. I'm not saying they would purposely do anything like this. But at the same time, I don't think, you know, it's not like it was before where, oh my Lord, how are we going to keep people in? People are staying in with the economy the way it is and everything like that. People are staying in.
Well, there is the fact that it is a job, a steady paycheck, more or less, and the benefits are there. Okay. So, and this is not just happening in the tidewater of Virginia. This is also happening out in San Diego. It's happening at the submarine bases up in New England and out at Ballast Point, out at Pearl Harbor. What overall, in your opinion, Mike, does this do to a Navy like ours when this level of uncertainty and disruption begins to become a normal way of life?
Well, I mean, the way I see it, it looks like after, again, years of problems with maintenance of their ships and after years of uncertainty and unrest within their shipbuilding program, they kind of changed the way their destroyer program around, how we're going to buy different destroyers and things like that. It seemed like they were actually on the verge of sort of getting their act together, and now it's all thrown out the window. And that's what it seems like to me. It seems like the Navy is finally sort of like getting anchored again in some of the things they wanted to do and maybe get their programs and their house back in order, and now I think it's been totally disrupted. That's the way it seems.
I had an interview recently with General Whistler of the Marine Corps. He was the Deputy Commandant for Programs and Plans, and he talks about the fact that he arrived in his current job over 2 years ago, and the entire time he's been in the Pentagon, he's lived under this continuing resolution regime. There's never been a finished budget bill to go and work to. And when I asked him, well, how do you do that? He just smiled and said, well, we've come to the point where the continuing resolution is the new normal, and we have no expectation that Congress and the administration are ever going to pass a budget again. From your reporting, is it really that bad, or is there some hope out there?
In fact, what really upset the Navy officials more than anything else this year is that there is no continuing resolution right now. They were kind of counting on that, on a continuing resolution. In many ways, as onerous as it may be, it was sort of at least something stable, you know? But now they don't even have that. So it has become the new normal. You know, it's become the best of a worst situation. And
now even the new normal is disrupted.
Now even new normal. You don't have the continuing resolution like as normal as you would. And on top of that, now you have this whole sequestration thing. And again, sequestration is not – it's hitting operations. It hasn't hit, for example, the shipbuilding yet and things like that. That's pretty secure for the moment. By the end of this fiscal year, that'll start changing too.
In other words, somewhere when we start 2014 on October 1st, and for our listeners, it's important to understand that the government's fiscal year begins every year on October 1st and ends each year on September 30th. It's one of the weird reasons why on September 30th here in Washington, D.C., we have New Year's Eve parties. Anyway, so that all said, Mike, is there any sense that you've been able to gather in your reporting of late of what fiscal year 2014 looks like for the Navy from an acquisition as well as an operation standpoint, or is anybody thinking that far ahead yet?
I was just talking with Admiral Ray, and Admiral Ray's in charge of the inspection program down in Tidewater, and he says, you know, we're supposed to be putting together a whole budget for 2013, 2014, so we don't even have a budget passed for 2013. How are we supposed to do this?
So they've got no baseline to base next year.
Nothing at all. And so what they're trying, like in his shop, for example, what they're trying to do is they've already cut down on civilian technicians going out to do inspections with them. And they're going to rely on in-house naval expertise instead.
Which, of course, they've drawn down over the past few years when we started doing
outsourcing. Right, and they're trying to rebuild now. Yes, and they're trying to rebuild that now. So what you know? That's what they're doing. The Navy mantra has been to do more with less, and that's what they're continuing to look at is how can we do more with less. And one of the problems that they're finding, for example, is that in the budget they proposed last year, they were cutting out cruisers in order to draw down some of the money that would be paid for operations and maintenance.
In other words, they were going to retire some of the older Ticonderoga-class Aegis cruisers to help go ahead and pay for newer ships.
Right, and now the Senate has decided to put money back in for those cruisers. But that money is coming from someplace else. It's not as if they're going to raise the top line for the Navy. And the Navy officials have said, we've got to convince the folks on the Hill we can't afford them. But that's the kind of things they're trying to work through, is they can't find ways to cut down on some of the money that they're putting out. Some of it's politics, and some of it's people who really on the Hill think they kind of know Navy's business better than the Navy does, decide, no, we want those ships in there. And there's an awful lot of political ping-pong going on with Navy programs right now. And get to your question, they've really just they're like adrift. That's basically what they are. They're essentially adrift. They've got some contingency plans in place for anything that happens, and they've been planning for that. So they do have plans in place, but for right now they can't pull the trigger on any of them because they just don't know what's going to happen.
Now, regarding it was reprogrammed to go ahead and get the Lincoln – refueling and rehab program going over at Newport News, as well as the reprogramming of monies to get the Eisenhower Group out. You told me that there was a little trick that our friends in the Navy had used, a little-known budget tool that allowed them to reprogram across budget accounts
without
having to ask Congress for it. Talk a little bit about that, because I heard a lot about something similar being passed in Congress to do that for DOD and several other agencies across the board this weekend.
Well, here, the way it was explained, the named officials came out and said basically it's above this above threshold reprogramming funding. The way that the CRS explained it was essentially what they did was they said instead of counting this as a new start for 2013, they instead counted it as a new start for 2012. Back in the fall, back in September of 2012 is when they did this.
In other words, we're essentially making the money go back in time.
Exactly.
As if we have a time travel machine for budget purposes.
In this case, that's what they say. So, okay, we're going to say this is – now, what CRS points out is that, you know, okay, that's fine, except we're going to, you could wind up with, since it wasn't really budgeted until the coming year, so you could wind up with a shortage of funding now as a result of that, so, you know, for this coming fiscal year. So we'll see if that happens. But that's what essentially what they did. So instead, you know, you had, you know, in budget numbers, you had a 7-0 to 1 – from 2012 to 2013, they push it all back a year.
You cover, you know, obviously the Navy, but you also cover the funding out on the Hill.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my question is, what do you think the chances are that Congress is going to be able to go and actually get something in a spending flexibility bill for reprogramming across accounts through sometime in the next month or so, and oh, by the way, which the president has already said he'll veto, but do you see the Congress being able to go ahead and pass anything like a spending flexibility bill in the next 4 to 6 weeks?
Yeah, Congress has always been loath to give up that kind of authority. I mean, that's one of their golden chalice, if you will. You know, of their power is to hold, you know, this is what you're, not only this is how much money you get, but this is how much you're going to spend it, you know, how much you're going to spend and exactly what you're going to spend it on. And as I said, with shipbuilding programs especially, they really spell out exactly what they want you to spend the money on. I'd be very, you know, so far they've been very low for it. However, in the last week and a half, you know, talking, you know, inside the Pentagon, to some of the sources, they feel maybe a little softening that there might be, given certain language and a lot of caveats, some reprogramming authority. It would be very strict, but there. And I don't know if that's just someone floating, you know, up as they say, a trial balloon to see, hey, let's see how this sounds, because, you know, a lot of people leak things, reporters, for that reason. They get out there and they see how it sounds. But that's what they felt, a little softening. But that would be the first inkling of that. Because Congress has just not been willing to give up any of that authority at all.
And in spite of all this, there is a new deployment going on of a brand new warship. And we're going to talk a little bit about this because, Mike, you've been leading the charge to go ahead and understand what's going on with this new program of a new class of ship, or actually two new classes of ship, called the Littoral Combat Ships. Explain what LCS, as we call it, is conceptually, and explain the two classes of ships that are being built as a result.
Okay, conceptually, what they wanted was they wanted a ship that was very fast. At sprint speeds. In other words, they want to be able to go from one place to another very quickly.
And when we're talking fast, we mean 45 knots, which is like fast enough to get you a ticket on a country road.
It's something. When I was on the Freedom, during the most recent certification trials, to go to Bridgewing was an effort just to get the door open. We were going at such high speed. They also, though, wanted something that really carried for size, we're talking somewhere between a corvette and like a frigate size, something for size to carry an awful lot of whatever that could be material, that could be in a certain place supplies. The basic idea is to fill up containers. I mean, and just for, you know, for layman's, you know, purposes, picture kind of a trucking container that's filled with a package, a prepackage of, it could be a weapon system, it could be a system with a underwater unmanned vehicle, for example, to go out and hunt for subs or something like that.
So these are the so-called mission modules that you're talking
exactly.
about.
Sprint to areas very as quick as it can, and then kind of like and go very close to the coast because the Navy, most of the ships are deep water ships. They're built for, you know, transits and lurking about out at sea, but they want something with a very shallow draft, around 12, 15 foot even, to kind of get as close to shore as possible. And so that was the idea of the LCS. The LCS, they tried some of this before, like cyclone ships and other ships that hadn't quite worked. But with this idea, they thought they had it where they could basically get, if we get kind of a lightweight ship, not very highly armed, not nearly as armed as, you know, like a destroyer or, as it turns out, even a tanker, and get close to the coast, this is the kind of ship with the niche that they don't have right now.
Now, when we say small, we were originally talking, what, 1,200, 1,500 tons. How big is the USS
About
Freedom?
About 3,200 right now, full displacement.
So, in other words, it's the size of the Oliver Hazard Perry-class frigates it's going to be
yes.
supposedly replacing.
Right. Well, one of the ship's classes, because the Navy's very quick to tell you, we're not replacing frigates one-on-one with these. It's frigates. It's minesweepers. You know, it's, you know, and whatever else they want to save for that day type of thing. It's historically been the case.
Two contractors were awarded contracts to build prototype littoral combat ships. One was Lockheed Martin, and one was General Dynamics. And talk about the two designs that emerged from this.
Okay, the Lockheed Martin design essentially is, you know, it almost reminds me of a mini cruiser in a lot of ways, because what it has is that it has that aluminum deckhouse on top of a traditional steel hull.
And we're talking about a design a lot like a cigarette racing boat, a semi-waterplaning monohull.
That's right. In fact, it's taking that design and, shall we say, tweaking it for military purposes. And that's a good description of that. The other ship, which is by the GD team, the real shipbuilder for that is Austal USA. Austal is an Australian company that's built these ferries that go back and forth. I mean, we're not talking small distances. Some of these ferries go back and forth, you know, the Tasman Sea. I mean, these are
very large auto and passenger ferries that go overnight, hundreds and hundreds of miles between
yes.
ports.
Right. Now, this design is all aluminum. And what I liken to, if you've ever seen, again, Star Trek analogy, if you've ever seen a Borg ship, the back of it looks like a Borg, big Borg cube that someone stuck the front of a traditional hull, although it's all aluminum. And the effect is a trimaran hull.
So it's actually one big hull in the middle with two sponson hulls off to the side.
Exactly. And the one thing that the Austal version gives you and no one is because of the design of that cube in the back, a tremendous amount of deck space for aviation type of things. We're looking a lot at Fire Scout UAVs and things like that off of that back. And inside, immense space for storage. The version by Lockheed, on the other hand, has one attribute that the Austal version lacks. The stern doors open in the back and allow what they hope eventually be very quick and rapid launching and recovery of pretty robust ribs that can do a lot of the interdiction.
These are the rigid hull inflatable boats.
Yes. So anyway, those are the two different variants, or actually they're really two classes. One is the Freedom class, and that's the Lockheed version, and the other is called the Independence class, which is the version that Austal and GD have put out. Now, they two have two contracts. They want 55 ships going out, and basically a split between the two of them is the plan right now. And that's what it is. They're about halfway through that buy for that, and that's what they have right now is that split between the two.
And these don't have propellers. They've got water jets for propulsion. They're very maneuverable, obviously. How have they done in terms of testing thus far?
Well, the Freedom's been out to sea the longest, and that's the one we basically have most of the information for. And the Freedom has had a very troubled past. you know, get beyond the programmatic part of it, that the ship, both ships were costing more than we're supposed to, and, you know, the kind of lead of the class programs you see, especially Navy shipbuilding. Getting beyond that, though, ever since the Freedman's put to sea, it's had a series of problems. You know, going everything from going dead in the water, which happens, but it's had major shaft leaks. It's had engine shutdowns. You know, it couldn't go
through
Panama Canal one time.
A lot of corrosion problems, as you've pointed out in your reporting.
Right. It was even stopped from going to Panama Canal for because of engine problems at one point. I mean, you've had some are lead first of class issues. Some are just issues just because you have a ship, quite honestly, they have a lot of disparate systems from all around the world on there. And quite honestly, they're not quite working just the way the Navy figured them for, to be honest. And even the Navy, the top brass for Navy has said, in their own words, is as if the ship wasn't sailorized. It's as if that sometimes the Navy wasn't part of the design process. They've had to kind of almost refigure their own minds how they're going to use the ship based on some of the systems they have and how it's operating because some of the problems they've had thus far. The Navy put together a special high-octane admiral board, the LCS Council, and they spent a lot of money, but it looks like they're getting the freedom back on track. In fact, the ship just left March 1st for its first forward Asian deployment in Singapore.
Talk a little bit about the turnaround. You know, you've been reporting on this class of ship for over a year and have done some pretty fine reporting on it. What have you seen done by the Navy, including this Admiral's Council overseeing it? What have you seen that has gone and made the early prototypes of these ships not only better but capable of an overseas deployment at this point?
Well, going back a year, roughly, well, a little bit more than a year ago, I was given a chance to go aboard the Freedom as it was in dry dock in San Diego. And I have to say that the ship was a rusty and in many places rotting mess. And I agree with this, that the folks who, you know, sources of mine who were intimately aware of the program said that the ship had no business being at sea even. And I'd have to agree from what I saw. You had
in other words, the material condition of the ship was not worthy of an extended trip to sea.
No. I mean, you had basic inner vital piping systems that were absolute mess and leaking all over the place, causing corrosion problems all throughout the ship. Deep down in the engine room, we would not expect it from a ship that had been at sea, you know, for a relatively short time when you really look at it. And also, the other part of that was that the Navy, to the highest level, especially NAVC, was continuing to maintain that they had fixed everything with the ship that was not anywhere near the shape that we saw it in. Since then, the Navy has done a 180 in two things. One is in acknowledging all the problems with the ship. They really have been over backwards to say, yes, quite honestly, we messed up in how we built the ship in a lot of ways. We messed up in how we did the quality assurance of it, and we've really messed up in getting a message out about this ship and some of its problems. Then on top of that, they've really put the money out there and put the ship into a condition where I would say, judging from what I saw, it was ready at least to attempt a deployment. We'll see if it, you know, everything goes as planned.
Now let's talk about
one of the
major concerns, of course, is, and we've touched on it a little earlier, was that these are very lightly manned ships. In other words, there's really two crews. There's the crew of the C frame, the ship itself, and then the crew for the various modules down in the stowage areas. And these, in any case, were lightly manned. There was a documentary on National Geographic recently where they were interviewing one of the crewmen, and she talked about the fact that she actually had, like, four different jobs that she could remember off the top of her head and a couple of others she couldn't. I mean, there's a lot of multitasking going on with personnel here. Talk a little bit about that.
And there's key. The core crew for this is 40. And quite honestly, even the Navy folks have gone back and said, you know, that was kind of an arbitrary number. And with that key core crew of 40 run that ship frame, having such major tasks, for example, of being the navigator as well as engineering type of thing. Because of that, the one thing that they were never meant to do was the kind of maintenance that needs to be done for ship at sea. The idea was that they would report most maintenance issues to someone ashore, and there was going to be a special team ashore that would take care of maintenance. Well, as it turns out, that just was not working out at all. And for the Freedom class anyway, they've decided they need at least 10 more crew members right now for more maintenance and for watch standing, because the way it was working before just was not working out. And the other problem was that despite the fact they had a very thin crew, the automation on this ship was not that great. Now, the Navy officials will talk about there is more automation. That's true. But this ship does not have the kind of just generic automation that a commercial tanker has had for the last 15 years. They're doing things like going down operating valves manually for things like oil transfers, back between tanks, that, again, commercial tankers had had for more than a decade. And as a result of that, the Navy folks say they are looking at putting more automation on the ship that we might see in later versions. Now, part of the way they're doing this is through this LCS Council. This LCS Council, which is headed by Admiral Hunt, includes some of the top, brass for the Navy. And the idea is that they can, take shortcuts through the bureaucracy, not in the work they do, but in the way they get the work done, to make sure they get some of the changes down the line.
Sort of like NASA's Better, Faster, Cheaper initiative from some years ago.
Right. It seems to be, working. I mean, you've already got roughly 300 changes from the Freedom to the next ship, which is the Fort Worth.
And the class, which is LCS
number 3. Right. And they're already talking 100 changes.
Fort Worth?
Yes. And they're already talking 100 changes from the LCS 5 to LCS 7. So they're getting the changes through pretty quickly. And I would venture, what I've seen, a lot of the major issues they have with piping and other issues on the LCS 1, the Freedom, you don't see cropping up on Fort Worth thus far. And there's some classic examples right off the bat. For example, for Freedom, because of some weight issues, they had to tack on two pretty significant extensions on both sides on the stern of the ship. And now that has been actually included in the overall design on the midsection, middle part, for the Fort Worth. And the Navy officials say they're actually getting a better running ship with that. So, and the other one that you're seeing on the Fort Worth that you don't see on Freedom is the stern doors. Stern doors are supposed to be watertight. That's where they launch and recover those rigid inflatable hulls.
And the remotes, yeah.
Right. But because the initial design, in order to keep the ship nice and light, because the cardinal rule for the LCS class ships is that for every pound even you put on, you have to take a pound off. That's how tight we are with these ships in terms of margin.
So there's basically no margin for weight growth anywhere on the ship at this point.
No. So to keep the weight down, they put on aluminum ramps to launch and recover the ribs. Well, when the Navy personnel put the ribs and to store them on those ramps, it buckled the ramp and pushed out the stern door for the Freedom. This is what they think happened. The end result, definitely, though, was a gap that you can put your hand and part of your arm through, and it runs about 25, 35 feet wide.
Not to mention aluminum and salt water do not mix well.
Oh, well, the whole region, at one point we got a hold of some emails that showed that you were getting 17 tons of water on that ship when it was going at high speed. Because we're sloshing
around. In other words,
around.
The ship would actually take on 17 tons of water
right.
into various leaky points in the stern door and other places.
And this is at a very key area of the ship. This is where the mission modules are a lot of equipment is kept. And everything, again, in there was
and a significant chunk of the operating crew lives in modular berthing spaces down
exactly.
the same deck.
Exactly. You know, so at any rate, Fort Worth is supposed to have a fix, but the fact of the matter is Freedom, you know, I was out in the certification trials and you still were sloshing it. So they can't get that fixed on one, but on the later ships, it looks like they've come up with a design change they think will address that. So that's an example of some of the things they've done with the ship so far, and it looks like it's working. But, again, we won't know until – not only – we won't know – even if Freedom go out and deploy, the change is so significant, you have essentially a redesigned ship. So until Fort Worth gets out and operates in the water, you won't know if all design changes are working for those two ships, for example. And then you won't know until probably around like number seven ship is out there if they have production model or not.
So the fourth unit of the Freedom class is really going to be the first production class, production unit of the class, assuming that they get the fixes done.
Did you say the Fort Worth?
You were talking about LCS-7.
Yeah,
the fourth
7
unit
or 9
of the,
will probably be the first production models you see for that.
Okay. Now, that said, the Navy is conducting a great experiment right now and has dispatched USS Freedom with a fancy new Drazzle camouflage paint job to go ahead and do a trans-Pacific cruise to Singapore where it will operate and be based for a period of months and then come on home. Talk a little bit about the voyage of the USS Freedom and what its intent is and what your own plans for going and looking at it are.
Well, first of all, it's the proverbial very slow boat to near China. It's not scheduled to arrive there until mid-April. It's making several stops along the way, at least one in Guam, and the Navy officials are kind of not saying exactly where else. And this ship, well, first of all, it's got to make it there. I mean, the entire program essentially is riding on this deployment. And no one expects this deployment to go without a hitch, but they expect the deployment to be successful. Successful means it gets there, it stays there for a while, how long they won't say, and comes back. So that's the important part right now. And the Navy, what they see is ships like the Freedom going into places like this and showing American presence is not a shown American power, but it is a shown American presence in areas they could really never go on before. You know, you put a carrier, even a destroyer, in a certain place, that sends a message. And in this part of the world, that kind of message, it might not go over too well. But a ship like Freedom can go into these kind of areas and go up there and say, see, we are planting our flag here a little bit. And also, an awful lot of the world's navies are kind of, they don't like playing necessary exercises and other things with big Navy ships. There's a lot of reasons for that. Part of it is just a cultural thing. There's an inferiority thing. But the Freedom's that kind of right mix. It mixes well with other navies around the world. And so here you can go into this whole part of Pacific pivot. You can go into these ports, these areas that normally have not had any kind of American presence or very little. Forward base a ship there, so already you're having a bigger presence by forward basing it there. And then it can make, you know, essentially little calls here and there. It's going to be testing out logistics trains and what it's going to take for the crewing as well as material for put the ship forward. But it's also going to be kind of, a goodwill tour, if you will, in some ways.
And you are going to go and get to see a piece of this.
This is the idea. You have the Index show in Singapore in mid-May. It's sort of like for you aviation folks out there, it's kind of like the Paris Air Show, except for Asian maritime. And this is going to be kind of Freedom's big Asian prom. And so she'll be on display there, and I'll be heading over to cover the conference as part of that. Get a chance to see it in the foreign port and see how it's weathered the storm, so to speak, or the storms or the ocean.
See how the paint's hanging on to the side of the hull and things
like
that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You've been covering this now for over a year under occasionally very acrimonious circumstances. How do you see this program holding up in light of sequestration and the other continuing resolution issues that we're going to be dealing with in the next, obviously, 3 or 4 years while the Obama administration plays out its run here in D.C.?
Here's the dilemma the Navy is facing right now. It's kind of simplistic, but still. The Navy, even if it gets the reprogram authority for the money, it has to make a very big decision. That big decision is this. Do we go to sea with what we absolutely need right now to answer our mission set? Or do we fund missions we know we say we need in the future and programs we need in the future? And for right now, I mean, there are some congressionally mandated things. These are things of policy, these are things of treaty and things like that. They have to reprogram money, a good chunk of it, would have to go right away to doing availabilities. That's in other words where ships come in for maintenance periods. You get the ships fixed to go out and do missions that they're responsible to right now. There's a real concern in the Pentagon right now that money's going to have to come from things like the Freedom, like LCS. And it wouldn't affect necessarily, I mean, you have the ship buy in place right now for the first, you know, dozen plus ships. And they really think they're going to get to eventually that 55 number. But what it could do is you could wind up delaying that for a bit. That middle chunk.
Stretching the program out.
Which, of course, makes the ships more expensive when you do that. That's just, you know, sort of, you know, economics 101. Now, at that point in time, does Congress kind of say we aren't willing to spend X amount for a ship like the Freedom? It's hard to say. But there is definitely a concern that you could see this program affected for that mid amount. And also, there's a school of thought that you could wind up with a cheaper ship if you were to, as they say, down select, even though they selected two different building teams right now.
In other words,
now,
go to just a single contractor to go ahead and build just one of the two classes of ship out to the 55.
Absolutely. So, you know, you could do that. You know, it's...
But, of course,
and
that would insult several congressional delegations from several very large states.
That's the problem. The politics of once you've gone down this path of awarding a dual block buy contract like this, you know, once you're in someone's, you know, house like this, you know, the squire's rights, it's hard to get them out. And so that's the problem when you go down this road right now. You already have these contracts in place. Instead of, like, an argument of whether you should give something to someone, take that away can be much more difficult. And so right now the politics with that, it's going to be very difficult to probably get this down. Having said that, LCS is certainly cited as a program at risk as the Navy decides what it has to do with some of this money.
Well, I have to say that for an inaugural show, we've presented a particularly bleak and sometimes dark view of what's going on with this one service of the U.S. military. Is there any good news out there as we sit here on a Monday morning wondering what's going to happen next, or is it going to be batten down the hatches and hang on?
Well, I think, you know, part of the good news is when you look out there, I mean, despite all the problems internally, it's not like the bad old days of the Cold War where you had to worry about some of the other folks coming out with something with, you know, huge and mean that could, you know, was a real game changer. Right now, we're sort of, you know, we've got the best equipment anyway, and the question is, how do we keep it going and how do we invest in the future without breaking the bank? So I guess we have a little bit of lead time in worrying about that. But, you know, it's not a whole bunch. And for years now, you've had folks everywhere from the Congressional Research Service and other folks, CBO, for example, warning about, you know, Navy shipbuilding coming to, you know, ahead. You've got too many programs vying for an increasingly smaller pot of money. And the good news from this actually could wind up being that the Navy does get forced, maybe for the first time, to really sit down and come up with programs that, you know, make sense, or at least make sense in their own mind. And In other words, they can't have everything, and now you have to really pick and choose. And this could be the good news from this, that they actually do pick and choose whether they want to or not, and then at least you won't have them trying to keep all these balls in the air, and they're spending money here, money, a little money for this, a little money for that, a little money for this, a little money for that. And in the end, they're only getting about 80% solution, if that, maybe 7% solution for most of their programs. That makes sense.
Mike, I want to thank you very much for coming and talking to me today. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And for those of you who are listening, Mike, please tell them where they can see your work.
Well, the easiest place is aviationweek.com. And it's either going to be on stories. We also have a pretty robust blog there for defense called ARIS. And every Friday I put out a weekly blog called NAV Week, kind of give some things that we wouldn't necessarily put in story form, not necessarily my opinion, but kind of a little maybe hints as to what folks might be really thinking about.
And you're also, you have a social media presence on Twitter, where you are?
Oh, and then Fabi, on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn, so.
Very good. And for those of you who want to see my reporting on this, I'm both on Facebook as John Gresham and on Twitter at GreshamJ01. And you can find my blogging efforts on the DefenseMediaNet.com site of Faircount Media Group. So please feel free to go and have a look-see at what we've been saying and what we've been doing.
Thanks,
Mike,
John,
thank you so much, and have a great afternoon. Talk
you
to you
too.
Soon.
All right, talk to you soon.
For those of you who have come and listened to our inaugural broadcast, thank you. Thank you for going and letting us help ourselves to learn how to do this and how to grow a bit. We will be back with another show next Monday, and hopefully we'll be having some more positive topics in the future, because it's not all bad news. The people out there who are in the fleet, on deployment and such, they're doing their jobs, whatever we do back here home. So just stand by them. Let's go and try and give them a better deal. And thank you so much for listening. Daria, please, any final comments?
Oh, hey there, John. Well, I just want to say excellent show. You did fantastic. I know it was your first broadcast, and it went very well. And I just want to let everybody know to please check out the Rightstream Radio Network here on Blog Talk Radio, just blogtalkradio.com/Rightstream. And tomorrow I will be broadcasting at 1 p.m. Eastern Time with my guest, inventor, author, and patent expert, Bill Chandler of Andante Publishing. So check that out.
Very cool, and, Daria.
Yeah, I'm really excited. It's going to be a really good show. And for anyone who missed it, I also joined in with Lisa Tarvez yesterday on her show, Just Believe, which is also part of the Rightstream Network. And again, you can check out that archive by just going to blogtalkradio.com/Rightstream and listen to your heart's content and share with everyone you know. We're really working on building up this network, and we appreciate your support.
Thank you, everyone, and remember, it's Military Monday at 1 o'clock. Thank you.